The fault is in our stars and in the Chinese economy. Author John Green on the program today. Also, the challenges, shall we say, of Chinese economic indicators. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, the 19th day of October. Great to have you along, everybody. You know how sometimes we give you an economic indicator, we tell you what the number is, and then we say, yeah, but hang on, because there's a bit more to the story? Today is, as you probably guessed by now, one of those days. And it's not the American economy we're talking about here either. New figures from Beijing show the Chinese economy grew at an annualized rate of 6.9% last quarter. That is just a hair better than estimates, even as it's a number that shows growth in the Chinese economy is in fact slowing. If, and this is not a small caveat here, if you believe the numbers the Chinese government puts out about its economy. A lot of analysts don't. They say if you really measured it, the growth figure for the second biggest economy on the planet would be closer to 3%. Why should we care? Marketplace's Kimberly Adams asked around about that today, and here's what she got.
GDP may or may not be the best way to measure China's economy, but for what it's worth, markets use gross domestic product to measure growth. And when the markets don't trust those numbers, that's a problem.
Whether you believe in the numbers or not, the reality is that this uncertainty is very problematic for the global marketplace.
Nick Consonieri is with the Eurasia Group. He says it's kind of crazy that the world's second largest economy is so opaque in terms of its financials, but it is what it is.
The reality is that for the next few years, we're going to be in an environment where the uncertainty about China's growth is very high. And as a result, the uncertainty in the markets about what to make of China is going to be very high.
But as some analysts point out, GDP doesn't tell the whole story anyway. Ann Lee teaches economics at NYU and says China's economy isn't really slowing down that much.
China is a much larger economy right now. And so when you have a larger base, you can have slower growth and still have the same amount of economic activity going on.
With more people entering the formal economy in China, the rate of overall growth is going to be lower. Yukon Huang of the Carnegie Endowment says that's just going to continue.
So China will, 5-6 years from now, be growing at 5 or 6 percentage points and not even 7.
He says even if the GDP numbers are a bit off from month to month, in the long run, he thinks they pretty much reflect the reality of growth in China. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The ticker symbol of the day today, hands down, is WTW, Weight Watchers International, up 105%. It doubled, that is, on the news this morning that Oprah Winfrey has bought 10% of the company and will take a seat on the board of directors. Oprah said Weight Watchers helped her lose weight, and now she wants to, and this is a quote, partner in its evolution. So clearly, Oprah does still have the Midas touch, but Marketplace's Annie Baxter reports that Weight Watchers still has some underlying business problems to deal with.
The weight loss industry in the U.S. is a $65 billion market, according to John LaRosa at Market Data, which tracks the industry. LaRosa says while Weight Watchers still leads the industry, its revenue is flagging. He says part of the problem is that people don't want to spend money on weight loss programs.
Out of necessity, 80% or 82% of all dieters are do-it-yourselfers.
LaRosa says that's hurting companies like Weight Watchers and Jenny Craig alike. Another problem LaRosa sees, Weight Watchers hasn't been changing fast enough and still focuses largely on white, married women in their 30s.
They're using the same one-size-fits-all program that worked in the 1980s and maybe part of the 1990s.
But Weight Watchers says it will change more and expand beyond focusing on weight loss alone to focusing on leading a happier, healthier life. It's unclear how much its new mobile technology will play a role in that. The program's website now syncs up with devices like Fitbit to track physical activity. And so far, that change is appealing to 30-year-old Tom Robinson. He lives in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and has lost 60 pounds with Weight Watchers. He says the company's apps made a big difference for his participation. He didn't want to attend the meetings with fellow dieters that have been a hallmark of the company.
I had no desire to talk about my weight with anybody else.
As for Weight Watchers' partnership with Oprah, Robinson is optimistic. He says he's persuaded others to sign up for the program because of his success. He says if Oprah does the same, it'll be huge. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Wall Street today. You know who won big? Oprah Winfrey won big. That's who. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you're among the growing number of drone enthusiasts out there is news of interest to you today. The Department of Transportation says it's working on some new rules for unmanned aerial vehicles, as they are sometimes called. Chief among those rules, a requirement that one register one's drone as a condition of using the national airways. Marketplace Tech host Ben Johnson has been following all the drone comings and goings. He is here to make me smart. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Kai.
All right, drone registration. You have to help me understand how this is going to work because the FAA has not been speedy, shall we say, in drone regulation overall.
Not super speedy, Kai. The FAA actually missed a deadline, you may remember, at the end of September. Mm-hmm. This whole process has been moving slowly. Hopefully, that will change over the next few months because the Department of Transportation is putting together, yes, a task force, which we love in government.
We do.
Task forces. It's going to be 25 to 30 people. They're going to be representatives of government and regulators and also the industry. And they're going to put together a bunch of rules around registering your drones if you're a consumer. And they're going to put those rules together over the next month. And then they're supposedly going to finalize them by mid-December, right around the time everybody's going to get ready to unwrap their sparkling new quadcopters that they get for Christmas.
Because task forces move so fast, right? there is no small part of this that goes like this. I will register my drone when you can pry it from my cold, dead hands, right?
Yes.
There are lots of safety rationales for this. Give me the other side of this thing.
Well, if you want a real problem, you got to attach a gun to the drone.
Right. And there was that YouTube video. You saw that video, right?
Yes. Here's how it's different from, say, registering guns and the controversy around that. You've got a smaller number of people who are doing this, even though it's exploding. I mean, sightings of drones by pilots in areas where drones really shouldn't be flying is up 200% over last year. So this is a growing problem, but it's still a relatively small number of people. And it depends a little bit on how the FAA and the Department of Transportation rolls out these rules. Now, I talked to a guy, his name is Jonathan Downey. He's the CEO of a company called AirWare, which actually makes software and a little bit of hardware for commercial drones. And he said this registration process can play out one of two ways.
I think everyone's hoping that it's going to be a really seamless process. You buy your consumer drone, you go to a web URL, you type in your name, and you're done, and you're ready to fly. If you have to go and you write it out with a pen and mail it into some government address, and you don't hear back from them for 3 months or 6 months, you got your drone for Christmas, and you're not flying it until March. I think that's the nightmare scenario.
Yeah, no, and that's never going to work, right? But let me ask you another thing, Ben. Last time you and I spoke about drones, you had said it was going to be 2 years, plus or minus, before we see drones out there, you know, delivering stuff. Jeff Bezos, Amazon, he was the first guy really to talk about drone delivery. I know he's got lots of smart lawyers. How might this ruling affect what he and lots of others, we should say, want to do?
So I think that the business world is probably going to be watching this process closely, Kai, because the FAA and the Department of Transportation really needs to solve this problem soon. Now, the rules that they're putting together might not affect the commercial space directly, but what they will show is how these government organizations are thinking about regulation and figuring out ways to make this work. Now, if you're a company, you're definitely going to have to register your drones and make sure that the government understands how you're using it.
You ever flown one of these things?
I have dabbled, but only, you know,
super
as in one probably about as like about the size of a Frisbee, and it's super fun, but it's also a little bit terrifying.
a little bit. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. Also, by the way, the host of the forthcoming podcast Codebreaker. You can find a link to that on our homepage, marketplace.org. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Kat.
Down in Texas, over the past week or so, more than 50 homes were destroyed and 4,500 acres burned in what's being called the Hidden Pines Fire. It's about 70% contained right now, 70%, but residents weren't surprised it happened in the first place. 4 years ago, in that same county, Bastrop County, they had the most destructive fire ever in the great state of Texas. Afterwards, some residents packed up what was left and moved out. Some, though, like Kay Rogers, rebuilt.
What we're looking at used to be a beautiful stand of loblolly pines. This fire was indefensible. It was thousands of feet in the air, blowing 40, 45 miles an hour. A lot of people didn't come back, but that's because they lived on, you know, quarter-acre lots, and they were toasted. But we got 40 acres. Some of it didn't burn. We dragged an old travel trailer up here and lived under that barn over there.
Our old house was back here. I couldn't bring myself to tear down the fireplace, so we left it, and then we built what I call the pavilion around it. And so that's where our house used to sit. I didn't ever think I'd build back, and secondly, I didn't think I'd ever build back here. But when I found out we could cut down the pines that burned and have them milled, that caught my interest.
Come on in. I was talking to a friend of mine, and she was telling me about a girl down the hall from her had gotten some mill work done, and I said, well, we have a sawmill here. She gave me the man's name, and I called him from our little travel trailer. I remember sitting in the kitchen. We talked a long time, and I said, well, could you cut the trees down and take them to the mill? And so he milled them, and that's what we made all the walls and all the ceilings out of. I won't say I've always loved insurance companies, but having insurance made all of this possible. You know, people who weren't insured or were underinsured, you know, they've had a really hard time coming back because they can't build another nest.
We've got an audio slideshow of the house that Kay Rogers rebuilt. It's at our website, marketplace.org. Coming up.
There were definitely a couple of months when I would go to Starbucks every morning at 7:30 and then open up my laptop and cry for 3 hours and then close my laptop and leave.
And yet it was a bestseller. John Green straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, it's the happy music, but barely. The Dow Industrial is up 14 points today, less than a 10%, 17,230. The NASDAQ up 18 points, about a 3%, 4905. The S&P 500 pretty much flat, less than a point to the good. Ended things at 2033. Weight Watchers shares doubled on that news we told you about. Oprah Winfrey bought a 10% stake in that company. Nutrisystem slimmed down 8.1% today. Oprah, by the way, $60 million in the green after about 45 seconds worth of trading at the opening bell today. Also, there is word today that YouTube plans to put some content behind a paywall and take away the ads. Alphabet, formerly known as Google, and parent of YouTube, clicked up 0.2% today. United Airlines says it's going to release details about how to move forward after the hospitalization last week of CEO Oscar Munoz. United Chairman of the Board Henry Meyer III said in a statement the board is working on corporate governance reviews as we speak. United Continental up 1.3%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new residential construction for September. The United Nations marks its second World Statistics Day with the theme Better Data, Better Lives. Andy is remembered for his portrayal of Count Dracula. Actor Bela Lugosi was born on October 20th, 1882. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The president of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who is facing elections in just a couple of weeks, got a big boost yesterday from one of the most powerful politicians in Europe, perhaps the most powerful politician in Europe, actually. German Chancellor Angela Merkel, in a very quick visit to Istanbul, said she would support Turkish demands for European aid and faster European visa approvals for Turkish nationals. But reading between the lines here, she was mostly in town looking for help on the refugee crisis. Merkel's central role in tackling that crisis, agreeing to take in relatively large numbers of asylum seekers, has been widely praised outside of Germany. Domestically, though, not everybody welcomes that open-door policy. Marketplace's Stephen Beard from the European Desk reports on the backlash.
Germany was pummeled during the summer for being hard-hearted towards the heavily indebted Greeks. But now it's basking in a rare glow of international approval, praised around the world for its generosity, lauded especially by the refugees flocking across its border.
The best country with which give us the best welcoming is Germany, for sure.
They are so, so kind. They are really caring about refugees. I'm really happy, and every face is smiling here.
But with more than a million refugees now expected to have settled in Germany by the end of this year, the smiles and the welcome are wearing thin. Send them home! Send them home! Howls this crowd of angry Germans in the eastern city of Dresden. Whoever makes it to Germany can stay here forever, says the man with the megaphone. Are we living in a madhouse? This is a regular far-right protest. It began long before the latest influx, but it's now gaining strength. Anxieties are spreading. Doubts are growing about Chancellor Angela Merkel's snap decision to throw open the door and about her claim that Germany can cope. Michael Völgemuth of the Open Europe think tank in Berlin.
When she said, yes, we can, people thought, well, it's a brave statement. And now they're asking her how. And there are no clear answers to that.
City officials are struggling to house the refugees. Schools have been overwhelmed with non-German-speaking kids. Now even moderate Berliners like Peter Weiss and Rudiger Weinzen are getting worried about the scale and speed of the human tide.
I think the Germans, with their history, with Hitler, we have responsibility to help other people. But in this speed, I think it's a problem.
It's a big problem that they don't learn German. We have not enough space for all the people.
Few doubt Germany's economic capacity to cope. The budget surplus should cover all the extra costs, and the labour market should be able eventually to absorb the incomers. Unemployment is 4.5%, a record low. And Simon Tilford of the Centre for European Reform says more people is just what the country needs.
Germany is a fast-ageing society. Its population is much older than, say, Britain's or France's. The labour force is shrinking. This big influx could provide a very useful supply of labour.
Provided, he adds, that the new arrivals integrate, but that's what worries an increasing number of Germans. 51% in a recent poll said they fear that so many incomers from a different culture will not blend in. In a cafe in central Berlin, Gudrun Heisser voices a widespread reaction.
These people don't fit in here at all. They're loud and leave endless amounts of garbage around. On top of that, they discriminate against women. They have no respect at all for our culture.
Angela Merkel is under pressure to halt the inflow. So far, she's refused to put an upper limit on the numbers that will be allowed in. She's turned to her European partners for help. In this speech, he told other EU countries that they should show solidarity, accept many thousands of refugees, and share some of the burden that Germany has taken on. Europe, she said, will be stronger in every way if it stands united. But no other EU countries, apart from Sweden, are prepared to throw their doors wide open. And the southern Eurozone countries make a wry complaint. Merkel, they say, was not prepared to shoulder the burden of our debt. Why should we share the burden of her refugees? At the European Desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Even though you might not be able to place the name John Green right away, you're probably at least passingly familiar with his work. Green wrote a book a couple of years ago that was released as a major motion picture last year, The Fault in Our Stars, it was called. Dying Teenagers, Doomed Love, perhaps you've heard of it, yes? Green hasn't written a novel since then. It was a big deal, that movie. He hasn't written a novel since then, but that is fine by him because he's got lots of other things going on. Not too many of them having to do with literature, it turns out. So we called him up to talk things over. John, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Why did you, when you started writing books, what was it about sort of teenage life, teenage situations, I guess, that made you want to write to them and for them and about them?
I just think teenagers are really interesting, both as readers and as characters. I mean, as readers, they're interesting because I think the books that matter to you as a teenager matter to you throughout your life. And it's a period of your life when you're kind of forming your values. And it's just a tremendous privilege to have a seat at the table in kids' lives when they're going through that process. But they're also really fascinating as characters because they're doing so many things for the first time. You know, they're falling in love for the first time. They're grappling with these big questions of what it means to be a person for the first time. And that's really exciting stuff to write about, at least for me. It brings me back to that time in my life, which was a really intellectually vigorous time for me.
You know, you do a lot of interaction with, you know, juvenile cancer patients and stuff like that, and you write about really difficult stuff. Is it when you write, is it emotional for you when you write in sort of in the act?
Yeah, I mean, there were definitely a couple of months when I would go to Starbucks every morning at 7:30 and then open up my laptop and cry for 3 hours and then close my laptop and leave. So I'm sure that I'm sure it seemed odd from the outside. But I do. I like being emotionally involved in the stories if I can be. And I feel like if I'm not, then something's wrong.
Do you ever look around at where you have found yourself now with bestsellers and movies and millions and millions of dollars coming to you through your work? You ever look around and just go, huh, wow?
Well, it's definitely strange and disorienting. You know, it's an amazing thing to kind of have stumbled into such a platform and to have stumbled into such a large audience. But, you know, the main thing for me is taking pleasure in the work and trying to find ways into doing work that interests me and that I'm passionate about. And in both online video and books, I've been able to do that for the last few years. And that's what's really exciting to me.
You mentioned online video. You will know this. Listeners may not. Before I sit down and actually turn the tape deck on when I'm doing an interview, I ask people to identify themselves to make sure that I get it right. And you said, my name is John Green. I'm a novelist and a YouTuber. You have a substantial YouTube presence that plays a huge part in your life.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I've made a video on the channel my brother and I share, Vlogbrothers, every Tuesday for the last like 400 Tuesdays, except for one Tuesday when I had meningitis. so I really, yeah, YouTube is a huge part of my life. And, you know, Hank and I also share channels about educational channels, including Crash Course, where we talk about school subjects at kind of a high school or early college level. And, you know, I love doing it. I love online video. I love the community that's grown up around online video in the last 10 years. And I love making a video every Tuesday to my brother.
Do you think it's possible today for you to be a cultural phenomenon, which you sort of are, without some kind of online presence, without some digital thing going on?
I think it's possible. I think it's much less likely, particularly with young people. But I think that, you know, I think that if Salinger were writing today if he were Salingering off there somewhere in the wilderness, he would still be a cultural phenomenon. And his refusal to engage in those places would probably be seen as part of that cultural phenomenon. But to be honest, I feel like the internet, you know, at its best, gives people a voice who may not otherwise have a voice. So my hope for the internet is that we'll see a lot more people be able to gain audiences without all of the gatekeepers that have kind of controlled culture traditionally. And I think that's the best of the internet. That's the potential of it.
Yeah. When did you know you were going to make it as a writer?
Well, I mean, I haven't written a book in like 3 years, so I don't know that I've made it as a writer.
We're still working on that.
Yeah. So I still feel uncomfortable calling myself a writer when people ask me what I do or any of that. I feel like it seems weird to call myself a full-time writer because I've always sort of had a day job. Now my day job is making Crash Course videos and other YouTube videos. But I've always liked having a day job. So I don't know that I have made it as a writer.
John Green, you know him best probably from The Fault in Our Stars. He's written a bunch of other stuff. And you can get him on YouTube, too, as you heard. John, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Two things about that interview. Number one, John mentioned Crash Course, the education series he does on YouTube with his brother. Turns out our very own Adrian Hill is a contributor to the segments they do on The Economy. They are pretty good, by the way. Also, and just because I thought it was interesting, I asked John what it's like to see his books turned into big motion pictures. The answer and a link to Adrian in Crash Course at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out, today's two giant companies pointing fingers and saying, you started it, no, you started it story comes to us from Amazon and the New York Times. The Times had a big piece a couple of weeks ago about working conditions at Amazon and how supposedly terrible they are. We talked to the reporter on that story. There's an interview on our website. Today, Amazon spokesman Jay Carney fired back with a long post about what he says are errors in the piece. As I said, we've got links to that post, the Times piece, and to our interview with the Times reporter at marketplace.org. You read them, you decide. Whole lot of nothing at the corner of Wall Street and Broad today. The Dow up 14 points, less than a 10%. The NASDAQ up 18 points. That's a 3%. The S&P 500 pretty much flat, less than a point to the positive. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Robert Gurova, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.